It's the Week in Review on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two guests from different political perspectives unpacking the news this week. Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Nice to be on with you, possibly for the first time, but it's comforting to me to hear the same music.
At least you have the same, right. And Lon Newman joins us. He is the former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. He's also the former executive director of Family Planning Health Services in Central Wisconsin and is a Robert Wood Community Health Leader. Lon, welcome back to you.
Hey, good morning, Kate, and congratulations. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Lon.
Well, let's dig in. We've got a lot to get through, guys. The public weighed in yesterday at the Capitol on a state Republican bill that would prohibit these so-called sanctuary cities. The proposal from Senator Steve Noss would outlaw local governments from imposing policies that would prevent federal immigration law from being enforced. And Noss said at the hearing yesterday that sanctuary city policies are placing, quote, political correctness over safety. Let's take a listen.
Each local municipality cannot pick and choose which state and federal laws to obey or ignore. Otherwise, we no longer have a government of laws.
Well, Steve, this died last session due to the intense opposition. Does it have legs this time?
I think it has somewhat more legs, possibly. I'm not positive that it's necessarily got enough, but, it seems kind of like an obvious thing to me in the sense that, local governments don't decide immigration policy. That is something that the federal government decides. So based on my knowledge of what is actually in the bill, all that the state is doing is telling municipalities that you have to enforce the laws of the nation. There is a process to change the laws of the nation if you don't like what the laws are. But so that seems pretty straightforward to me, and I think most people, when you ask them about, do you think that government ought to follow their own laws, would say, yes, the government should follow their own laws.
Well, Lon, busloads of opponents came to the Capitol to speak against the bill. There was Christine Newman Ortiz. She's the executive director of Voces de la Frontera, an immigrant advocacy group, and she says the stakes are high for immigrant families.
They've lived through a period of deportations, of family separation, of increased discrimination. And they know this is not theory. They know the reality.
Lon, your thoughts on this bill?
I'm sorry, I was interrupting the soundbite there, I guess. I can see why immigrants are feeling persecuted, and most of the research seems to show that immigrant populations are not, are less likely to commit crimes because, of course, they are fearful that they might be deported. And the other thing that I'm really confused about, and maybe Steve or somebody else can straighten out for me, is that, it isn't a question really of the immigration laws being prevented from being enforced. I think the question on sanctuary cities is whether or not local law enforcement and local taxpayers have to, on their time and dime, do the federal immigration authority work. And the question is, with the sanctuary cities, I think they've said, well, they're not going to prevent the federal agents from doing their work, but they're not able to, and it would not be wise to try to do the federal immigration authorities' work for them. And the last thing I'd say is, here's an example of where, the problem really is perhaps one of enabling federal overreach and interference in local law enforcement and taxpayers. So, again, I'm a little puzzled that we have Republican legislators who are on the side of the mean old federal government coming in and co-opting local authority and spending local money.
Yeah, see, Steve, so, it seems as if cities aren't going to sit back and just do nothing here if they disagree.
And I think that one of the reasons that the Republicans support this bill, because it, I may be right, but I think that for one thing, there has been a fair number, not a large number, but a fair number and very well publicized number of cases of illegal immigrants committing serious crimes. And there's been an instance, for instance, where somebody was deported, somehow got back into the country and killed somebody. In my area, there was an instance where I'll say that I'm not positive that this person was an illegal, but ended up getting into a fatal car crash that killed somebody and killed himself also. And there were some questions in that case as to the legal status of essentially all of the people that he was driving in this particular instance. So that's, I think, really what this is. From the Republican perspective, to not allow local government to skirt the law. I do know that there are, you know, people in law enforcement who say that if something like this passes, that then immigrants will not want to talk to police. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to that, but that's the sort of thing that needs to be dealt with in the process of creating the law. Merely protesting the law, I don't think is going to necessarily change that.
Well, let's bring in a caller here, Chris in Williams Bay. Chris, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm a former police officer, and I want to point out something to both the guests and some callers that may come up. Law enforcement has a little thing called discretion, and so do prosecutors, which means they choose which laws to enforce all the time. As a perfect example, just a couple years ago, the local district attorney up in Jackson County, and people may remember this, chose not to enforce the concealed carry statutes in Wisconsin because he didn't believe in them. So when people claim that somehow that, you know, you have to enforce the law, that really is often a decision that is made by law enforcement. As an example, officers choose what speed limits to enforce on a regular basis. So, you know, this idea that somehow laws aren't being dutifully enforced is a local decision that many local agencies and local municipalities make all the time. And so that's certainly a red herring.
Chris, thanks so much for the call. Lon, let's get you to weigh in here. Discretion, as well as, do you think this bill is going to wind up going anywhere?
Well, I think the point that that Chris made about law enforcement is certainly true, that discretion is exercised and must be exercised all the time. Otherwise, we'd still be enforcing laws against, you know, saddling your horse and not picking up the poop through town or something, you know. So the other thing I was going to say, that we were speaking statistically when I said that immigrants are less likely to commit criminal acts than the general population. Any group of individuals, you know, from journalists from West Bend to priests and bishops commit crimes, you know, but that doesn't mean that we need to legislate against that class of individuals or create special legislation. There are, obviously, if they're breaking the law, there are already crimes involved. And of course, as Chris has pointed out, then the question is what should and could be enforced with the resources that, you know, they have. And the best determinant, again, I think, for local law enforcement as to what resources should be put where, it should be left up, for the most part, to local law enforcement. So, and I don't know, you know, I think, you know, the starting point, I think, Steve made was, you know, if we're going to have a nation of laws, or that was Representative Nass, I guess, was talking about if we have a nation of laws. I'm not really sure we do. What passes out of this legislature and Congress is sometimes so, you know, anti-rule of law, or, you know, the Trump administration, that I'm not sure what will pass anymore, to tell you the truth, Kate.
Well, we're talking right now on the Week in Review with our two guests, Steve Prestigard. He's a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Lon Newman is here as well. He's the former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. He's also the former executive director of Family Planning Health Services in Central Wisconsin. We're just missing you in the conversation. 800 1-800-642-1234. What political developments this week sparked your attention, caught your eye? What political developments do you want to weigh in? 800-642-1234. Let's rewind back to Sunday. President Trump released his list of demands in exchange for extending protections for Dreamers, or those who are brought into the country illegally as children. Under the Obama administration, they were given a reprieve from deportation and the ability to work legally in the U.S. And the president wants to overhaul America's green card system, crack down on the unaccompanied minors entering the U.S. and build the wall. Lon, what do you make of this list of requests in exchange for protections for Dreamers?
Yeah, I think that it shows clearly that the art of the deal was written by a ghostwriter and that Donald Trump really hasn't read it. Now, if he's going to follow his usual pattern on this deal that he's proposing, he will now start berating or tweeting against McConnell and Ryan, and at the same time he'll be tweeting about how much he loves the Dreamers and how everybody's gonna be taken care of. You know, I had a bad joke that maybe he could throw some paper towels out to the Republican Senate caucus, and then, you know, Senator Corker and Rubio could kind of jump up and it would improve the cable TV ratings.
A la Puerto Rico, I think you're referring to there. Yeah. Well, I want to get Steve in on this conversation. What about these hardline immigration tactics, Steve? Will they go anywhere?
You know, predicting this stuff is kind of dangerous, as you know. However, let's consider two things. First, Donald Trump's biggest motivation is about Donald Trump. Donald Trump's second biggest motivation is the people who supported him in the election. And everybody, I think, knows that the people who voted for Trump, which is different from the people who voted for Trump because he wasn't and isn't Hillary Clinton, but his hardcore supporters believe that immigration needs to be reduced in this country. But remember also that the only reason that the DREAM Act exists is because of an executive order from Barack Obama. And as I think everybody should have figured out by now, executive orders by one president can be overturned or changed by another president. And that's what's happening right now. There hasn't been a single thing that's been done permanently, or as permanent as exists in politics and the law, on immigration. Trump is trying to get, I guess, Congress to, you know, pass these changes, and Trump is obviously trying to figure out a way to keep some semblance of the DREAM Act alive. It should have been a law passed by Congress anyway, not an executive order. The thing is that, you know, the political calculation here is that even though Trump's hardest core supporters do support cracking down on immigration, the fact is, and the fact has consistently been, that most Americans do not support as hardcore immigration restrictions as, you know, deporting illegal immigrants. Most people have consistently supported a path to citizenship. Most people support, you know, to have to allow people who came into this country because of their parents, and presumably since they were minors, really didn't have any control over coming into the country, to be allowed to stay in this country. And Lon is absolutely right when he says that there's really not evidence that illegal or undocumented immigrants, however you'd like to call them, commit more crimes as a class than, you know, the nation as a whole. So, you know, as usual, politicians try to have it both ways. Trump hasn't done anything that hasn't permanently changed anything. And in fact, he's already said that the March 6-month deadline for ending the executive order, he could see it extended. So, you know, he's trying to get, I think, the right thing done, and also he's trying to get the right thing done that is supporters see in terms of restricting immigration.
They're
trying to do two things at once, which makes them a politician, doesn't it?
It is the Week in Review. On the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with Steve Prestigard, who's a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. And Lon Newman is the former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. He's also the former head of family planning and health services in central Wisconsin and a Robert Wood community health leader. You can join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. What political development this week weighs heavily on your mind? Let's discuss. Is it the Clean Power Plan rollback by the EPA or closer to home, the mergers set in motion this week for the two-year schools? Will your community be impacted? How so? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after a quick break on the Ideas Network. You're with us on the Week in Review. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our guests from different political perspectives analyzing the week's developments. They're Lon Newman is the former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. He's also the former head of Family Planning Health Services in central Wisconsin. And Steve Prestigard. He's a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. How about you, too? 800-642-1234. How does the UW's system restructuring plan sit with you, especially if you attend one of the two-year schools? What about the National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell asking all 32 owners to consider changes next week, saying that players should stand during the national anthem? Join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So let's go to move on to health care here. President Trump issued an executive order yesterday making low-cost health insurance premiums available to more people. Trump's actions would also allow some groups to purchase coverage across state lines. And here's the president commenting from the White House.
With these actions, we are moving toward lower costs and more options in the health care market and taking crucial steps towards saving the American people from the nightmare of Obamacare.
And at the same time, the president urged Congress to work to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Steve, is this move more ceremonial to show movement on health care because the proposals may not be finalized in able to affect coverage until 2019?
Possibly. I think it may well be that taken this long for the Trump administration to kind of figure out how they can dismantle Obamacare through executive orders and through congressional action, because obviously Congress cannot get its act together as to should we repeal it, should we fix it, should we replace it. But remember what I said before, that Trump's second biggest motivation is the people who supported him and voted for him back in November. And similar to that group's position on illegal immigration, Trump supporters look at Obamacare as a complete disaster and something that needs to be gotten rid of. It's kind of ironic, I guess, that Senator Rand Paul, who certainly doesn't like Obamacare, but at the same time, he wants a congressional fix as opposed to an executive fix, and he supports this. Perhaps he's figured out that this is that since Congress can't seem to get it back together for as much procedural reasons as anything else, that this is the best first thing to do to get rid of Obamacare. But again, remember, this is something his supporters support.
Lon, you come from a healthcare background. What do you make of this executive order?
Yeah, I find myself in about 100% agreement with Steve on his analysis. The only thing on the immigrant thing where he said Trump is trying to do the right thing, I'm not sure about his motivations. I think his description of appealing to the base is the right thing. And I think that, in that sense, appealing to the base, and I don't mean to be disrespectful about it, I think there's research to show it, but the base, Trump's base, doesn't understand healthcare any better than Trump or, our governor or the Congress or the legislature does. And so these measures, I think, Kate, you talked about being symbolic. I think they're really destructive, because in the insurance industry, they are banked on and depend upon stability, regularity, their ability to plan ahead. And what's happened over the, and this just continues the pattern of complete inconsistency and really chaos. And then now we're talking about, you know, removing these subsidies that they've relied upon to provide care to low-income people. So, you know, it'll, I think most experts are saying that it'll move the markets toward healthier, smaller, younger sort of plans with fewer guarantees because the requirements are no longer there, thus moving the poor and the elderly and the sick and, you know, these folks really out of any possibility of getting affordable insurance. And I just think for the most part, none of these folks, and this was clear, I think, even stated probably by Lindsey Graham in his last iteration of Republican legislation. You know, they don't really know what they're doing. They don't really have a clear and a comprehensive solution to any of these problems. They just keep kind of keep careening around the ping pong table here.
Let's bring in Randy in Madison, who has something to weigh in here on the executive action. Go ahead, Randy.
Yes, I think if you were to predict Trump's actions in the future, just look to see what Barack Obama accomplished in his term, and Trump will want to dismantle them. Right now, he's working on the Iran deal, and of course the Affordable Care Act, plus trying to do away with DACA and EPA Clean Air. The fact of the matter is, for instance, nobody really believes that he wants to improve health care. He simply wants to do away with what we already have. There is this white-hot passion of hatred for Obama that even exceeds that of the congressional Republicans. But right now that means that there's a hell of a lot of chaos in the White House, and most of our international agreements and treaties are limited-time offers.
Well, Randy, thanks for weighing in on that. And, Steve, before I throw it back to you, I want you to get your take on the situation in Wisconsin, because the Wisconsin Office of the Commissioner of Insurance released numbers yesterday showing that premiums for state residents buying health insurance through the federal exchange will be going up by an average of 36%, the hike attributed to decreasing competition after three insurers quit the exchange. Governor Walker said it's all proof that Obamacare is collapsing. He also said that if the law isn't repealed and replaced, Wisconsin will seek greater flexibility to do what it can to lower costs. Are we going to see more changes on the home front here on health care?
Oh, I don't think there's a question that we're going to see bigger changes. That's just the way it is, because you know, the thing with Wisconsin, and I covered in my previous life as a business magazine editor, I covered health care and health insurance, which, by the way, are separate things. They're not the same thing as, you know, some Obamacare advocates have tried to argue over the years, and Hillary Care advocates before that. Wisconsin had less problems with health insurance, I think it could be argued, you know, in the years between when Hillary Care collapse and when Obamacare was set. And the reason was that, you know, you had competition. Of course, the individual market is a very difficult market, but in the small group market, which is how most people are insured, you know, you had competitive prices, and at the state level, they passed various insurance reforms, and that was the way it should have been done correctly. Well, then came Obamacare and threw it all out. And I think it's pretty obvious that Obamacare was based on a flawed economic model that fixed things that didn't need to be fixed. In, you know, it may have fixed things that should have been fixed, but health insurance is something, because of the laws, they really should be decided at the state level. And, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that Walker is correct, that even though Wisconsin has, I guess, fared slightly better than other states have,
Obviously, things are going to change because Obamacare is just not economically, financially feasible.
Lon, let's toss it back to you here before we move on. On the state level, these changes are going to impact Wisconsinites. What about these rate hikes?
Yeah, I think people are going to be paying more and more for less and less in terms of health care. And I did want to expand a little bit on Steve's quite correct distinction between health care and access to health care and health insurance and access to health insurance. And I want to say we've tried to tinker around with health insurance and health insurance coverage and deductibles. And, you know, as he said, the individual market is problematic just from the start with catastrophic care so that you pay out of pocket. People don't really understand these things very well or how these markets work. And at the same time, back on the healthcare idea, we have not really undertaken, and I think we're not going to under these administrations, the kind of thoughtful, strategic measures that would bring healthcare costs down. Not health insurance costs down, they're dependent upon healthcare costs, partly, mostly, but healthcare costs. And I'll give a really good example that's timely, if I may, and that is something I know something about. There's nothing that saves more money and provides better preventive health care than contraception, reproductive health care, and STD prevention and treatment. And yet both the Trump and the Walker administrations, it seems from my point of view, which is pretty in-depth, has done everything possible to dismantle those preventive health care programs that really do reduce the cost of Medicaid care and other health care dramatically. And I've got numbers to prove it, and probably nobody's going to challenge my expertise on that. I ran an agency for 20-some years. So I know the numbers for which I speak, but that's a preventive program, preventive routine primary care that, you know, nobody seems to be working to support. And there's several other examples.
Well, let's move on here in the Week in Review. We've got Steve Prestigard with us, a journalist and blogger, and we've got Lon Newman, the former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. You can join in as well at 800-642-1234. We're going to be moving on now to discuss the Clean Power Plan repeal by the EPA. How do you feel about it? 800-642-1234. What do you think it will mean for where you live, for greenhouse gases, for how the U.S. And its role in curbing greenhouse emissions. The Obama-era Clean Power Plan is on its way out. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt signed off on a proposed rule on Tuesday to roll back the plan, which was designed to limit greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants. And let's hear Pruitt in Kentucky this week.
The past administration was unapologetic. They were using every bit of power, every bit of authority to use the EPA to pick winners and losers in how we generate electricity in this country. And that's wrong.
Lon, what is your reaction to this repeal? Winners and losers.
Well, I mean, he seems to be deliberately trying to pick coal as a winner. I mean, the whole thing is so ironic and so nonsensical. And I think, you know, look, the reality is coal is not coming back because it's no longer cost competitive with other energy sources, period. Secondly, you know, man influenced, impacted climate change is real. Every day, Mother Nature is trying persistently to get the attention of our attention deficit disordered administration. I mean, how can you deny? Now, I know it's not about weather events, and of course, we see climate, you know, contributing to these weather events. But there's these patterns are not really deniable, and we're trying to return to a past that never was, and sacrificing our future on these altars of ignorance. We really, this EPA appointment is almost as bad as a attorney general doesn't support civil rights. I mean, It really is tragic for the whole country, and especially Wisconsin, where our natural resources are the heart and soul of our state.
Okay, your turn, Steve, to weigh in here. This EPA repeal of the Clean Power Plan. Was the Clean Power Plan an overreach by the Obama administration?
That's a gross understatement. It was an overreach. It was absolutely, and I have to back up just for a second to say that I think that one of the most popular Trump appointments by, in the minds of his supporters was Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator. And the reason is that environmental overreach is part and parcel of exactly why Trump supporters voted for him. This so-called clean, first off, it's a canard to say that there is such a thing as clean power, because there are always environmental costs to any kind of power generation. Why don't you take a look, for instance, around all of these wind turbines in the area and look at the number of dead birds? Why don't, for instance, you consider the incredibly toxic batteries that are part of generating solar power? The EPA's Clean Power Plan was supposed to cost America, this was supposed to cost Americans $10 billion a year. And as it turned out, a study last year said that that was a little bit short, that the correct cost is actually $40 billion for a plan that would, really cause serious damage to the American economy in exchange for minuscule changes in global temperature. One good example of what this would have wrought is over in Germany. Germany apparently uses more renewable energy than this country does in terms of proportion. And to nobody's surprise, it shouldn't be a surprise, their electric bills for residences are three times what they are in this country. I think that listeners should, go back into their pile of paid bills, go check out their most expensive month, either for air conditioning in the summertime when it's really hot, which this year wasn't, or take a look at their worst electric bill and heat bill from the winter. Say that winter 3 years ago when it was 20 below zero for days on end. Take that worst electric bill and heat bill and triple it, and then ask yourself why you feel like we have to do this.
Well, let's get a caller in here on this, Joshua in Madison. Hi, Joshua.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. I don't know I forget the guy's name, but he just talked about how Germany costs more.
Uh-huh.
Steve, okay. Well, we are getting so far behind other countries on our technology and what they do and what we do. And we're trying to go back to a time when we're making companies basically pay less for things they do. They privatize their gains and socialize their losses, and we pay for that. In health effects of children, burning lead, or I'm sorry, burning coal puts mercury in the air, and these companies don't pay for that. We do, the people.
So, and Steve, before we move on here, is this repeal, this rollback, going back in time?
I don't know. I guess it would be interesting to ask people, and I'll just use one example about this, in Cassville in southwest Wisconsin. They used to have two big coal power plants. One was owned by an electric cooperative, a rural electric cooperative, and the other was owned by Alliant Energy. Both of those are closed. They don't have their major employer in Cassville anymore, and they have had all sorts of horrible things happen to the community, basically things like people dropping enrollments in schools, and there are no jobs in that area. And I'd be, that whole discussion about going back to the past, well, I don't know. I mean, in a sense, you can't. In a sense, it seems as though the market is already kind of dealing with this, because obviously at the moment, natural gas is considerably more popular, although natural gas doesn't count as a renewable, according to the most extreme environmentalists.
Well, let's move on here and switch gears, talk a little bit before the break about the National Football League Commissioner, Roger Goodell, who's been asking all 32 owners to consider changes next week, saying that players should stand during the national anthem. He said the issue is dividing the league from its fans and that the league needs to move on. Meanwhile, President Trump applauded Goodell on Twitter, saying it's about time he demand he got tough on players who kneel during the anthem. And Sunday night, we saw Vice President Mike Pence leave an Indianapolis Colts home game after about a dozen San Francisco 49ers players took a knee during the anthem. Lon, what do you make of all this?
You know, I'm confused, Kate. Again, I'm confused a lot nowadays. I guess I'm confused as to how peaceful, non-disruptive protest or an expression of support for constitutionally protected civil rights is disrespectful to the flag or disrespectful to veterans. As a matter of fact, I think that suppression of peaceful, nonviolent protest is what's disrespectful to the Constitution, to our Bill of Rights, and to the flag that represents them. It reminds me of, like, I'm going to pray for to my all-loving God for the destruction of my enemies. I mean, the irony is so clear to me. And so I really don't understand how anybody who's a patriot does not understand the appropriate place of public non-disruptive protest at a public event. Where else would you do this, in private?
Well, Steve, Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones suggested he'd bench players who disrespect the flag. What do you make of this situation?
Well, at least that's an accurate statement. There was a statement floating around social media that he said that he would fire players. That was not correct. He never said that. And the Kansas City Chiefs owner was also quoted as that. He didn't say that either. The NFL, as the employer of the players, does have the ability to set standards of conduct for the players. So that's the first thing. I think it's pretty obvious, based on the reaction, that the NFL kind of missed the mark in terms of how their fans were going to react to this. On the other hand, I'm going to do something that might blow Milan's mind here, because I'm going to quote from Rush Limbaugh on something that I think Juan might actually agree with. And he said no president should have dictatorial power over individual behavior. He really should agree with that, I think. A president should not be able to tell the owners of a business how their employees are going to act and how they're going to swear allegiance and all of that. That's up to the owners to do, and it is. And it's up to the owners to come up with a system of punishment if their employees violate company policy like it is in any other business. No surprise, Trump waded into something that he shouldn't have waded into, but the NFL owners do have the ability to, and because it's an employment situation, that's all it is, they have the ability to set codes of conduct for the players. Again, having said all of that, kind of the background on all, or in the background of this, is the fact that the NFL's labor agreement with the players is expiring in a couple of years. And there's a growing belief, I think, that there might be a labor shutdown. This actually might accelerate it, however, because it's pretty obvious that the players look at these, I don't think the players even look at these protests as being against, the country. I think they look at it as being against Trump at this point. And so this thing might, as the NFL kind of make it not get out of hand, I'm not sure that they're going to be able to do that.
It's the Week in Review on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Steve Prestigard with us, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. And Lon Newman with us, the former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. He's also the former head of Family Planning Health Services in central Wisconsin and a Robert Wood community health leader. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What did you make Wednesday of the announcement of the mergers set in motion this week for the two-year schools joining the four-year universities in the UW? Will your community be impacted? How so? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after a quick break. It's the Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here on The Morning Show. Steve Prestigard is with us, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. And we have Lon Newman. He is the former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. He's also former head of Family Planning Health Services in central Wisconsin. You as well at 800-642-1234. What political story weighed heavily on your mind this week? Would you like to talk about the UW restructuring? Join in at 800-642-1234. How does the UW systems restructuring plan sit with you, especially if you attend one of the two-year schools? Join in at 800-642-1234. And let's move on to that. UW System President Ray Cross announced a proposal this week to merge its two-year schools with its four-year colleges. The idea here is to boost enrollment at the two-year campuses, which have dropped by about a third since 2010. The two-year schools would remain open, but essentially make them regional branches of the four-year institutions. And the plan is said to make more classes available to two-year students and to ease transfers to the four-year schools. Let's listen to Ray Cross in a conference call this Wednesday with UW System employees.
The cuts in the past couple of years on campuses have been going on, and this is an effort to help improve the way we deal with that. But it's not intended in any way to directly produce layoffs or changes in employment.
Not intended to produce layoffs. Lon, what do you make of this move?
Well, I'm not clear what the relationship between enrollment and these changes are, but I would say generally saving administrative costs, cutting academic red tape, for students, you know, that's a good idea. And we have limited resources, so pooling those resources makes sense. The other thing, I think that technology makes instruction much more accessible from a much wider range of worldwide resources and expertise. So along the lines of education, you know, isn't just brick and mortar anymore. Collaboration between these institutions is certainly a solid forward momentum. So, you know, I would support it. I think that like local school buildings and schools, people in those communities are very wedded to and love their institutions for the access and education and cultural things that they bring to the community. So it's not easy to reduce resources and all, I understand. But I think the general theme is a good one of pooling resources and improving access for students. I don't have any clear understanding of why this would affect enrollment, but...
Well, Mark in Appleton has been waiting a while to discuss this. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Actually, I think this is not a good idea. The talk about that this is doing increase access is pure smokescreen. UW colleges is the institution of access. It's set up for almost 60% of our students are first generation. And so this idea to cover up the cuts, the UW colleges have taken massive cuts. They've taken massive cuts in terms of administration that makes it hard for the institution to function, but also it's hurt recruitment. And the irony is that the governor keeps talking about tuition freeze. UW colleges, the tuition is 40 to 50% lower than the four-year schools, and still the enrollment has gone down. So, and one reason the enrollment has gone down is because curriculum has been cut massively, especially sophomore curriculum, which is leading to the enrollment cuts. And one of the people involved in those cuts was President Ray Cross. The cuts to UW colleges were greater percentage-wise than the cuts to UW-Madison. So the idea that this will save administrative costs, it's not going to work, probably. But the other thing is this idea that online is a solution to everything. You have a lot of students who will not function well just taking courses online. And well, technology is not that solution.
Mark, thanks so much for those responses. And let's get Steve now reacting here to what Mark said.
Well, as far as the plan goes, obviously the devil's in the details, so it's hard to say based on one soundbite or, you know, some media stories as to what this is really going to entail. But I guess there's a chicken or egg question here. The caller seems to believe that that cuts to the UW colleges have reduced enrollment. Is that the case, or is the fact that UW colleges enrollment has dropped, therefore, you know, cuts have taken place? I don't know how you can be opposed to administrative efficiency. You know, there will be job cuts, obviously, on the administrative side at the UW colleges. But on the other hand, you know, the purpose of the UW system is to educate people. It's not to employ people as, you know, either as faculty or as staff. And I don't know why people wouldn't be in favor of, you know, better administrative efficiency. Certainly, there are a lot of UW four-year schools that have, you know, have a lot of commuter students.
And I really want to get Lisa here in Mondovi to weigh in very quickly, Lisa, as we are short on time. Go ahead.
Me?
Yeah, go ahead, Lisa. Oh, and Lisa, I think, has dropped. I wanted to say here, we have invited President Cross to join us during our state capitol report on Monday to talk about the proposed merger, but haven't received a response yet from his office. And we'll be talking with a critic of the plan, Democratic State Senator Janet Bewley, who will join us after 7:30 on Monday. Let's move on now to, quickly, as we're short on time, the Democratic race for governor of Wisconsin got a little more crowded this week with former state Democratic Party chair and retired attorney Matt Flynn starting his campaign. And let's hear a clip.
Very simply, I'm running because I can't stand by and watch our democracy destroyed. Donald Trump in Washington is corrupting our government, dividing our country, and pitting Americans against Americans. And in Madison, Scott Walker is destroying the Wisconsin way.
And so Lon, Matt Flynn entering the race?
Well, I should say I've known Matt and Mary as personal friends for over 35 years. I think he's one of the brightest, most articulate, and most highly principled citizens of Wisconsin. He probably has more hair than you'd see in a Kennedy Brothers family photo, but if we need a ferocious advocate for equal opportunity for all, I think Matt will bring that to the debate. I love the fact that there's this rich field of Democratic candidates. I think there's political blood in the water from both Scott Walker and Donald Trump, and I think we need some sharks. I think our gubernatorial candidates have been a little more genteel than Governor Walker's rather sharp-edged campaigning calls for. So I'm glad. The more the merrier. And let's take this show on the road and point out the differences between these two parties.
Well, Steve, very quickly here, we're about to wrap up. Any thoughts on this growing race we're seeing here?
You know, no disrespect intended to Matt, but whose book I have, by the way, Prime Number, he was a novelist at one point, I guess, but there's a list of people who it was thought would be really good candidates as Democrats to run. Matt Flynn's not on that list. He's never won a statewide race. He's never won a race, period. And
we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both for joining us. Steve Prestigar, journalist and blogger, steveprestigar.com. Lon Newman, former chair of the Portage County Democratic Party. This hour was produced by Bill Martins with technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. Thanks for listening and hope to see you tomorrow at WPR's Centennial event. I'm looking forward to it. Hope to see you there. We'll take care.